Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Lisa Aitken is a clinical psychologist specialising in spiritual growth in her practice at Eagle Psychology, and as it turns out, one of our more downloaded podcasts each time we chat. Today we turn to anxiety. It's one of the most common mental health conditions in this country. On average, one in four people, one in three women, one in four men, will experience anxiety at some stage in their life. In a 12-month period, over 2 million Australians experience anxiety. Lisa, welcome back to Open House. Let's start with what the differences between stress and worry and anxiety.
Oh gosh, they swirl into each other a lot, don't they?
Yeah. Well,
from a psychology point of view, anxiety has a lot to do with the physical symptoms of adrenaline being released. So, and also a lot to do with anticipating something unpleasant happening in the future. So that sort of trembly, shaky, anxious feeling that we have when we're fearing something in the future. Stress is much more about perhaps feeling overwhelmed, about being tense, you can't relax, you've got too much on. But it's not necessarily a fear about things that are difficult in the future. But, you know, obviously they morph into each other and they swirl around. But from in the world of psychology, that's how we differentiate them. In everyday language, I think we often use the words interchangeably. And worry is a subcomponent of anxiety. It's the thinking part of when we're anxious.
So what does it look like when somebody is really being driven by anxiety?
Well, there's different parts of us that get impacted by anxiety. Probably the most prominent one that people experience is the physical part. And the best way to explain this is imagine you are walking down a dark alley. It's 2 a.m, you're there alone, and you are hearing heavy footsteps coming up behind you, getting faster and faster. Now, at that point, your mind is anticipating something negative in the future.
Yeah.
And your body responds in this wonderful survival mechanism. So you get adrenaline released, and I'm sure you're familiar with this idea of fight or flight.
Amen.
That starts to happen. So your heart starts to pound. Really useful, because you want blood in all your major muscle groups ready to run or to fight someone. So your heart's pounding, it's speeding up, your breathing rate becomes more rapid because you want oxygen in your cells to create energy. Your muscles start to tense in anticipation of all of this. In fact, your blood vessels in your whole body start to dilate, including in the major muscle groups in your legs, which, you know, sometimes you feel shaky, you get jelly legs when you're anxious,
because
the blood's actually pooled in your legs. You start to sometimes shake or even perspire in anticipation of your body expending all this energy. So all of those things are so useful if you're literally having to fight or run. But what happens to most of us is we're not in those sort of scenarios very often. And the threat is more like you wake up at 2 a.m. and you're thinking, oh my goodness, I think I might be going to lose my job. Now the threat is a thought, but your body responds in the same way. The adrenaline gets released, your heart starts to pound, your breathing becomes shallow. And a lot of people, when they come to me in my rooms, people say things like, I think I'm having all these chest pains, I'm worried I'm going to have a heart attack. But when your breathing becomes really rapid and shallow, all the little muscles between your ribs all start to ache and can start to pain, and you can get chest pains. So you can be lying there in bed at night with these full-on awful physical symptoms. Even though there's physically no need for them, our body still responds like that. The adrenaline still gets released. So that's the physical part of it, all very unpleasant at that sort of level. The other thing that happens is the focus of our thoughts change. And again, it's a survival mechanism. So that what happens is if you're running down a dark alley at 2 a.m, that's not the time to be philosophizing about the meaning of life.
Absolutely not.
And so your thinking narrows and narrows and narrows just to the threat. What is helpful is to pan out and think really big picture, but all of your hormones are saying, no, we've got to focus on the threat. You try and do this sort of problem-solving thing in your head, which just goes round and round and round in circles. And you can get stuck in these patterns and habits. And without some outside help, say from a psychologist, it can be you can feel really trapped in them, and then your body responds, and then you're not sleeping well, so you can't think clearly anyway, and, you know, it just goes round and round in circles.
Lisa, the one word, anxiety, has a number of very distinct variations beneath it. OCD, phobias, panic disorders. Let's start with generalised anxiety. What makes it distinct from the others?
Generalised anxiety disorder, these are the worriers of the world. I'm sure we all know someone with,
yes,
with TAD.
Yeah.
It affects about 3% of the Australian population in any 12-month period. That's about how many people would be diagnosed. And it really is characterised just by constant worry. You can't calm down. And even when there's nothing specific to worry about, there's this sort of free-floating anxiety that's there. Now, you can imagine, for people who are trapped in that, they're still getting milder versions of these physiological responses, but nonetheless all the time. So their muscles are tense, so they get a lot of headaches. Their hearts are always pounding a bit, their blood pressure's up a bit, they're not sleeping well, they're tired. You know, it really starts to impact in life. The other thing sometimes, which I've had a few people recently actually in my rooms, worry that they have this sense of sort of being outside of themselves. Our jargon is derealization, where you have a sense of a sort of distance, almost that you're standing back watching yourself, and it freaks people out.
Yeah.
But it actually is just part of the physiological aspect of generalized anxiety disorder, well, a few anxiety disorders.
We are living in troubled times, though, Lisa. How do we know that our response to our environment isn't a standard response and that we may, in fact, be living with generalized anxiety?
According to the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, a long word for it, it's the sort of the criteria by which we diagnose disorders. It would be more than 6 months of constant worry, where you have more days where you're worried than you're not worried.
Right.
So it's really impacting life. And often this goes on and on and on. And you can pick it up in children, sort of late primary, starting to develop it. They're often the perfectionists. They're very sensitive. They're seeking lots of assurance and approval, and then that can sort of carry through into adult life. And it's very much characterised by the thoughts about what if.
Okay.
What if this happens? What if that happens? And I'm just amazed at the scenarios that people come up with.
Yeah.
You know, my husband's 20 minutes late from work, and so someone will sit there and think, what if he's had a car accident? And then they're imagining the car accident, and then they're imagining their response, and what if this, and what if this, and it goes, the jargon we use is catastrophizing. Everything, you know, you quickly go to the catastrophe.
Okay.
And then your body responds.
I'm going to ask about treatment in a few moments' time, but to the extent that I wonder if treatments vary between, say, generalized anxiety and panic disorder, we'll go to panic disorder now, and then we'll come to treatments in a moment.
Okay.
If generalized anxiety affects 3%, as you say, potentially of the population.
Mm.
Is panic disorder a lineal extension, if you like, of generalised anxiety, or are there those of us living in that space specifically?
Yeah, they can be quite separate. They tend to be separate. It interestingly, also is about 3% of the population, but that's just more of a coincidence, I think. I mean, well, look, when you're anxious, it can get manifest in different ways across the course of your life, but panic disorder is quite separate. And it's whereas generalised anxiety disorder is that low hum of chronic anxiety, panic disorder, as its name implies, is the sharp, intense burst of panic, of fear of impending doom, which feels like it's just out of the blue and very physical. People, it's horrific to watch. People feel like they're choking, they can't breathe, their heart rate is wild, they're shaking, they're sweating, they get hot flushes. And often that feeling of derealization again, of disconnection, they think they're going to go crazy, they think they're having a heart attack. It's terrifying. It's really terrifying. And it can last for between 10 minutes or 30 minutes, which is actually a long time, and it's that intense adrenaline burst that's just really overwhelming. About half of the population at some point in life will have a panic attack,
yeah,
this random thing, and that's neither here nor there. It's just part of coping with a difficult world. Sometimes our bodies react like that. It turns into panic disorder when you start to actually fear having these panic attacks, and they're happening a little bit more often.
Are we talking about the same treatment for both, or are they unique?
They're similar, but they are different treatments. So panic disorder, when your body responds like that, your mind obviously starts to also freak.
Yeah.
Starts to say, oh my goodness, there's something wrong, I'm going crazy, I'm having a heart attack, this is terrible, what is wrong with me? And a big part of learning to calm yourself when you're having a panic attack is to be able to, instead of let all those things just go through your mind, to be able to say, this is just adrenaline. This is a surge of hormones. I can't rush it. Once it's released into my body, I just have to wait. And so there's skills and strategies to learn about how to calm your mind in the middle of a panic attack. And slowing your breathing rate is really crucial, because for any anxiety disorder, there's these two aspects. There's the aspect of managing your thought life, because that triggers so much of the anxiety. But there's also the aspect of managing your body. So slowing your breathing, even holding your breath for a bit in the middle of a panic attack, relaxing your muscles. Those are the things which actually mean that the symptoms start to abate. And then there's managing your thinking, managing your thoughts about it.
Yeah.
If it's panic disorder, it's also very gently and gradually working alongside a psychologist, getting back into the places where you've been quite fearful. And even if a panic attack is starting to emerge, you know, practicing those skills of calming yourself down.
So let's draw the strings together on this conversation, Lisa, around generalized anxiety and panic disorders. Where do we start within ourselves, within our families, to deal with this before even perhaps we call a psychologist like yourself?
Well, a little bit of educating yourself. Beyond Blue is probably the best website. Really clear, just information there. Learning to some basic things like learning to relax your muscles.
Okay.
It sounds really basic, but yeah. Exercising, keeping your muscles sort of toned and relaxed is really helpful. Learning to do some deep breathing, just that calming of your body. Some mindfulness, which is about focusing on the present. So all of those, look, they're quite common sense, just calming strategies.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely help. If it's really getting in the way of life, though, you probably do need to see a psychologist to help work through how to catch that unhelpful thinking, how to let it go, to walk you through managing it. But by all means, I think Beyond Blue is a great first step.
Okay.
And then it might be seeing your GP and getting a referral to a psychologist and having a chat.
Specific phobias now. And there are a number of broad churches within this area, aren't there?
There certainly are, and you can look on websites and get the list of names that, you know, you get asked in trivia questions. What's the Latin name for this phobia? But as psychologists, we sort of lump them into five categories. So common phobias. So there's animal phobias. A lot of people are scared of dogs, especially children, snakes and spiders, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you can see some sort of common sense in that. I don't know that many people aren't a little bit scared of snakes or spiders.
Yeah.
It can develop into a full-blown phobia. So there's animal ones. There's also nature phobias, and heights comes into this. So a lot of people are quite scared of heights, or things like thunder or lightning. There's a third category is blood or injection phobias. So some people, as you would be aware, just literally faint at the sight of blood or
yeah.
refuse to have blood taken, won't have injections done, which can obviously be really problematic if there's health issues involved. And then there's other phobias about specific situations like elevators. I've spent many an hour going up and down in elevators helping people overcome their elevator phobia.
Is that right?
Or bridges or escalators. Or it's really quite random. And then there's a catch-all, the fifth category of just others, fear of choking, fear of something falling on your head. Like there can be all sorts of weird and wonderful things. I have a secret theory, it's not based on research, but that we all have something which could develop into a phobia. We might just not have encountered it in the world yet. It's really quite unclear what triggers it. I mean, for some people it is. Some kids develop a phobia of dogs because they've been bitten by a dog. But for many people, it's very random, and the research really isn't clear what actually causes it. So you can, it can be that what happens is you're exposed to the thing, whatever the thing is, that's run with snakes.
Yeah.
And a thought, a different thought has been popping in your head of late, maybe because you've been around all these people who are scared of snakes. You know, what if it were actually to bite me? And then you start to develop some of the physical feelings of anxiety. This is all happening very rapidly in your head. It's not very slow and conscious, but you might start to develop a bit of heart pounding and, you know, rapid breathing and feeling a bit swirly. And then what happens is people start to avoid the thing that they are feeling phobic about. And then they think, well, the only reason that the snake hasn't bitten me or the elevator hasn't plummeted or, you know, the dog hasn't got to me is because I haven't been anywhere near it, and that's what's keeping me safe. And you develop this sort of avoidance cycle.
Okay.
If it's, for example, like I know there's many children I've treated with dog phobias where they won't go to their friends' houses if their friend has a dog. They won't go to parks if there's a dog there. Or people who work where they work on the 20th floor, but they have an elevator phobia, which means they have to walk 20 flights of stairs every day to get to. And fortunately, the help with phobias has a really good success rate. The treatment, it's called exposure therapy, which sounds
horrifying.
But it's done very gently and very gradually. And so, for example, with the child with the dog phobias, that the children that I've worked with, you start off showing them a picture of a dog, and then you notice that some kids, you know, if it's a scary German Shepherd or something like that with teeth barred, they do start to get some physical symptoms of anxiety. And at that point, you start to teach them different ways of coping with those feelings. So rather than shutting up the book and running off, it's some deep breathing. Watch your thinking. What are you saying to yourself? You know, what if this dog is a vicious dog and bites people? Learning to let go of some of those thoughts which aren't helpful, but especially a lot of calming your body down. And then you move from a book to, and this is the fun bit, I love treating kids with dogs, because you get to go to pet shops and get the cutest, smallest cross poodle Bichon puppy that you can find, little fluffy thing, and you get them to just pat it through the cage while, and even then they can get quite panicky, so then you're teaching them how to calm it. Then of course the next step is the next week it's on their lap, they're taking it home for the weekend, building up until you get to them face to face with big dogs. You do it very gently, very gradually, and all the time making sure that they're skilled up in different ways of managing the anxiety.
Turning to social phobias, Lisa, where, say, a dog phobia means you just don't buy a dog for a family pet, social phobias actually put relationships with each other under tremendous stress, don't they?
Oh, definitely. They have a much bigger impact, usually, on people's lives. So social phobia, or social anxiety, it's sometimes called, is a really intense fear about other people's evaluation or criticism. And it becomes problematic because people will avoid settings where there are other people, which, you know, of course has a huge impact on life, or do other unhelpful things to manage their anxiety. So I've certainly sat with people who, you know, won't go to parties because what tends to happen when they're at a party, they start chatting to someone, and then inside their own head, they're thinking, oh, this person probably thinks what I'm saying is silly, is ridiculous. And then they start to panic a bit. And as the physical experience of anxiety starts to overwhelm them, maybe they're thinking, oh, I can feel myself going a bit red, or I'm probably looking a bit shaky. Now, in the person with social anxiety's head, they feel like they're pulsing like a giant red beetroot and shaking, you know, violently. In actual fact, they're probably not at all, and the other person's oblivious, but there's been a good amount of research about how it's a really much more severe estimation of what another person is thinking about you than actually is going on.
Is it easier to trace, Lisa, where the roots are to this phobia? Is this always connected to a dysfunctional relationship in our formative years?
Not always, but often. And often the form of the fear of criticism that people have running around in their heads, in my clinical experience, it does go back to difficult relationships in their past. So, for example, I've had clients who wouldn't say get on a bus and assume that people must be looking at them and thinking bad things about them. And the content of the criticism went back to things her father used to say to her. Or people who maybe after church just make a run for it because the thought of that social, you know, chit-chat afterwards is too overwhelming. And especially if, say, it's men talking to a woman, because they've had difficult relationships with men, and they're assuming that other men are thinking about them, the things that perhaps men in their past have said to them. So, yes, it definitely, I think the themes of the criticism come from the past, but the problematic part of social anxiety is that a thought pops into your head and you assume it's true. Oh, this person, I've had the thought that this person thinks I'm an idiot, or they can see how anxious I am, and there isn't a sense that this is just a thought, this is words in my head. It feels true.
Yeah.
It feels like reality at that point. And then your options are, if you don't want to feel that anxiety, that people either just never go to parties, don't go to church, don't go on a bus, and I've counselled lots of young men and women who come to me for, say, binge drinking or for problems with drug use. And actually those things happen when they're in a social situation. They're really anxious, and their way to cope with it is to have too much to drink. It's interesting in the world of anxiety. There's the anxiety per se, which is miserable to feel all those experiences in your body. But a big part of the problem with anxiety is that we develop unhealthy ways to manage it,
yeah.
Whether it's drinking, whether it's coming home and watch and, you know, being on the computer all night, because that way we just don't have to think or to feel, or gambling or eating too much chocolate, or, you know, there's all these ways that we have, let alone just straight avoidance of managing the anxiety. And then they become problems in themselves, because yeah. These things are all habit forming. And we're so easily conditioned as humans. So what starts to happen is you start to think that, gosh, the only way I could cope in the party is to drink. And if you don't have a drink with you, then people start to feel like there's something really unnatural and not normal here, and I need that drink. And we get trapped into behaviours which we don't like, but they've, just by sheer repetition of them as ways to manage the anxiety, we sort of get stuck in them.
Lisa, I'd imagine as a therapist, this particular phobia is a real challenge, in so much as it takes a great deal of courage for somebody to call a therapist when suffering with this disorder, and then in turn, when in therapy, second-guessing everything you as the therapist might be thinking about me as the patient.
That's so true. And so there has to be lots of checking in as a therapist of, so are you having any thoughts right now about what you think I'm thinking about?
Yeah.
If that makes
sense.
And then learning to detach and just observe those thoughts. They're just thoughts. And I think good therapy enables a person to get into this place of observing themselves, observing their own thinking, and asking the question, is this helpful or not? To me, it's part of being made in the image of God, is this capacity for reflection, for standing outside ourselves and observing ourselves. You know, animals can't do it, but we can. And we often don't do it. But it's fantastic when you can, because it enables you to step back and assess, is this thought helpful? Not is this thought true? Because when you're at the party and you're panicking and all of your adrenaline is focusing your thoughts on the threat, it feels true.
Mm.
But is this thought helpful for me to be the person I want to be? That's a good question. That comes out of a type of therapy called ACT, or acceptance and commitment therapy, which is a really great one for anxiety. It's a type of CBT, or cognitive behavioural therapy. So definitely in the therapy room, lots of getting people to look at, observe themselves, think about their patterns in relationships. At what point do you run?
Yeah.
Do you not cope anymore? And what does it look like if you force yourself to get on the bus and sit there and tolerate all those yucky feelings and learn to say to yourself, I'm just having the thought that they're saying this. I've got no evidence that they're actually saying this. It's just a thought. And slowly you can start to manage it. The other good point that you make, though, in terms of the difficulty as a therapist, is not only are they assuming what I'm thinking, but social anxiety, you need that same exposure in the same way as you need to pat the dog eventually,
okay. Yeah.
To overcome that phobia.
Yeah.
You need to be practicing it in social settings, and it's really hard. It's all very well for me as the therapist to send them off and say, right, so your homework is go to a party this weekend and practice it, but I'm not actually with them or supporting them, or and may or may not do it. So often this is felt really well in group therapy, where you get, especially with children, because social anxiety is quite common with children, but also with adults. So a group of people where you're practicing tolerating all those difficult feelings and thoughts in the context of a group. And that's probably the best type of therapy for social anxiety.
Lisa, without bashing social media, would it be better perhaps that somebody suffering with a social anxiety disengage from those kinds of conversations?
It might. Certainly for some people, that's what they decide to do. It's just too overwhelming. You know, they post something and then there's days of anxiety waiting for what are people going to post back? Have they liked it? And if they haven't, you know, responded, then they must think that was stupid. And so for some people, if they don't need to be on social media, actually retreating might be an answer. Or even better would be using that as an example as you're working through it to learn to let go of those anxious thoughts of, oh, my goodness, I haven't responded. What's going on? You know, that's a great little task to work on of thinking, okay, these are thoughts in my head. They're not truth. Now, I know that sounds so easy just to say, but there's a whole bunch of skills to learn about how to let go of unhelpful thoughts, how to cope with these difficult feelings that well up inside of us. So it's great to do it alongside a psychologist as you go along.
Lisa, as a Christian therapist, let's turn to people of faith who are living with anxiety disorders. There's a sense somehow that we are failing in so much as we know and love an all-powerful, all-forgiving, all-knowing God, and yet we're still feeling this way.
Yeah, it's a good question. I have so many Christians who really struggle with anxiety who come to me and they say, but it says in the Bible, do not worry.
Yeah.
And my whole life is revolving around worry at the moment. For me, I think, you know, whether it's for the depressed person and the scriptures say be joyful always, or the angry person where the scriptures say be calm and patient, or the lustful person where we're meant to be pure, or the anxious person where it says do not worry. For me, we're in a fallen world and we have to be compassionate towards ourselves for our brokenness. And our brokenness for each of us just takes a different form. Everyone has some way that it gets expressed, and based on our biology, on our genes, on our upbringing, on our own habits, our own choices. And to me, so for example, when the scriptures say, or Jesus says, you know, do not worry but pray, for example, or do not worry but seek his kingdom, I take a really big picture perspective on it, that in heaven I will have a new body, no dodgy neurotransmitters, no overreactive amygdalas, and my thinking patterns will be perfected, and I will be in the presence of that sovereign God. Now, I am working towards becoming who I will one day be. One day, I will not worry. That's absolutely true. And I don't take that do not worry scripture as a rebuke or as a condemnation for those who worry. I take it as a gentle exhortation that one day that's where you'll be. So let's work towards getting there. And there's gentle steps. And prayer is a fantastic antidote to worry. It's not a magic cure by any means. But when we're praying, because worry is so much, anxiety is about our lack of control and our fear of the future. We do connect with the one who is in control. Mm. But B, it gets us in a place of thinking big picture, which counteracts that physiology of narrowing down on the threat. So often in therapy with people, we pan out and look really big picture. What is the meaning of your life? What do you see God doing in your life? You know, how really, really big picture stuff. And Jesus, you know, whereas there's the do not worry but pray continually in Philippians, Jesus talks about don't worry but seek first his kingdom. Again, a really big picture aspect of it. Yeah. So for me, it's I don't think as Christians we should ever rebuke someone with anxiety with the but it says do not worry. It's really that is a place that we're heading for, and it's two steps forward, one step back for those of us with that particular struggle. In the same way as you would never want to rebuke a depressed person and say, but it says be joyful always. You know, that's a direction to head. It's who we're going to be one day, and we're in the process of slowly becoming that. And depending on our issues. It's harder in some areas than others.
Lisa, are there some online resources that you're a fan of as a therapist that you could direct us to recover from these anxieties?
So, again, Beyond Blue is a really good website. A lot of information about anxiety and some online treatment. There's a place called CRUFAD, which is at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, and they specialise in anxiety disorders, and they have a website as well. There are quite a lot of online treatments for anxiety disorders. So I guess you go to a website initially to get some information.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, as I said, then would go to a GP, and the GP may well... So, you might begin with some online work. So there's, I think it's CRUFAD, who has a clinic called This Way Up. And you literally work through, you have weekly appointments online.
Wow.
Working you through some of these principles.
Okay.
And the research is saying that can be quite effective. So obviously for people for whom being on a computer is really comfortable, and there's other people who would much rather sit face to face. But that, you know, that's certainly a possibility. Yeah, and I guess as, for Christians, I always encourage Christians to think about a Christian psychologist, because when you're dealing with looking at your thoughts and what's helpful and what's unhelpful, and potentially then wanting to replace those thoughts with more helpful thoughts, I think it can be great to have someone who's coming from a Christian point of view. My all-time favourite theologian, Tom Wright, has this great quote. He says, "If you're a Christian, you are a shadow of your future self." We're heading towards being more fully human, more made in the image of God. And, you know, one day we'll have a resurrection body which will be perfectly restored and entirely free of anxiety. But we can participate now along the way of overcoming these, of being freed up from some of these things. Now, some of us, that might be our Achilles heel. Anxiety might be something we struggle with and we make progress with but never quite resolve. You know, that is our lifelong work. And others of us, it will pop up more recently, and we really can make an almost complete recovery from a specific anxiety disorder. But either way, I think it's exciting that as Christians we are on this journey, you know, not just of taking off the old self. We're not just getting rid of anxiety because we just want to get rid of something horrible. It's as we get rid of it, life opens up. We have different choices. Life becomes more free. And I think we've actually become more and more fully human. More and more we see what it means to be in the image of God.
Lisa, thanks for sharing the anxiety journey with us.
It's been a pleasure, Dwayne.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.